If we could move out, you've mentioned one or two things already, and sort of more into the Thorn and Hatfield area, which is obviously the area of this project. You've mentioned marsh forts and that kind of thing.
Yes.
What can you give me a picture of, say, pre-Roman?
Right. Okay.
Of that part of that area.
You're largely looking at a rural farming community. Probably very dispersed farms, and I think you can push this as far back as the Neolithic when settlement of the landscape begins, and the nature of settlement in those areas, I think is fairly sort of self-sufficient farms. There's nothing in the way of villages, not until the early, well, certainly not until the Roman period in any, and arguably even then, you wouldn't call it a village. You know, it might just be a cluster of families or farms in an area. So I think pre-Roman, well, I mean, you obviously have things like what is termed as the marsh fort at Sutton Common. It's arguable whether it's a fort or not. In fact, I don't think we fully still understand exactly what it is. Research is still continues on that site, and it seems to have most archaeologists or non-archaeologists hate this phrase, a ritualistic motif, and it doesn't seem to be being used as a settlement site or really as a fort, although it has all the accoutrements of an Iron Age hill fort, in that it has ditches and it has banks and it has walls, palisaded walls. But I suspect that is something more to do with appearance, creating an appearance, than it is to do with real defence.
What kind of age are we talking about? What kind of date?
Well, the recent excavations seem to suggest that at least some of the activity on the site is Bronze Age. And that extends into the Iron Age, and even into the Romano-British period. So there seems to be a sort of continual development of the site. But it certainly seems to be that what's happening there is people are interacting with the wetlands in a very interesting way. If you want to call it religious observance, perhaps that would be perhaps the best way of describing it. Although I think that there's more to it than that. But it seems that certainly in pre-Roman times, most of the settlement seems to be right on the very edge of the dry sort of upland areas and marshland, and it sort of follows that tide mark all the way up through the borough on either side of the limestone ridge, and they're using the dryland, but they're exploiting the wetlands, and these features like the marsh forts at Sutton Common are something to do with their connection with the wetlands and how they see the wetlands as both a resource but also as something which is quite mysterious, quite dangerous, and perhaps even quite otherworldly, because I don't know. I went out onto Hatfield Moors recently when we were looking at the trackway, and bearing in mind, obviously, you're looking at a landscape which has been milled and stripped, it's still, there are still parts of it that are intact, and it has sometimes just a very otherworldly feel about it. It's quite, it's not particular. It is inviting, but it's not. There's kind of an edge to the place. You get these rolling mists sometimes that run over it, and the dark water which is sort of blackened by the peat, and the mass of trees and ferns, and it can be quite a solitary, uninviting place, as much as it can fill you with awe because of the sorry. Hello. I did ask nobody to put a phone call through because I'm doing an interview at the moment. Okay, right. Okay, sorry, Peter. Thanks.
Is the marsh fort actually in the marsh then, or is that on the edge too?
The marsh fort is well. I mean, it's close to the edge as you can get, but it's sitting on two sand islands within the sort of marshy area itself, and between the two sand bank islands, you have a paleo channel, which is part of an old tributary of the Tarn, which is long since dried up, but would have still been. Would have still been sort of a relatively wet channel in the Bronze Age, and certainly in the Iron Age still. You know, it wouldn't have been a flowing river, but it certainly would have been a wet channel.
And what makes you say that you think there's a ritualistic aspect to the finds that have been made?
I think the most sort of outstanding find of recent years are the skulls, which were the human skulls, which were placed in the terminals of ditches by one of the entrances in the large enclosure. They seem to date to the Bronze Age, I think, and they're in the very upper fills of that ditch, and it seems that you might speculate that when that site was closed off, when its use had come to an end, the last thing that they did as they closed that site off was to put two human skulls in the ditches by the entrance to guard or perhaps to guard the site, or to ward people off or to ward evil spirits off. I mean, you can sort of let your mind run wild with ideas of you know what the site is and the significance of particular finds, which is one of the great things about archaeology, is you can use your imagination, but also one of the frustrating things sometimes is that it's very difficult to get into the mindset of somebody who lived centuries or thousands of years ago, and it's difficult to know what they were thinking when they did something or what something meant to them, what significance a particular object had or what a particular action meant, and of course you can only really speculate using the evidence, but it certainly doesn't fit the bill of a normal settlement site, somewhere where, you know, somewhere that is simply domestic. It's everything there seems to have something more to it. You have Bronze Age burials at one end of the large enclosure. The whole enclosure is filled with what seem to be granaries that would be standing on stilts. But why put granaries on a wetland site when you try? If you're trying to dry grain, you don't put a granary on a wetland site. because the grain will, you know, it's no, if it's damp or it gets wet, it's no good. None of it makes sense in terms of domestic usage, but it all seems to point to an idea of it being used for something else.
Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at sort of the Thorn and Hatfield Moors area from the Neolithic period, there are people living around the edges of it, are there?
Yeah, it would seem that people in the Doncaster Borough, in the wetland areas, people are right on the fringe of the dryland and the wetland. Recent excavations at Syke House near the Barrier Bank have turned up sort of late Iron Age settlements, a cluster of round houses in a relatively wetland environment, but it's just on the edge of the proper wetlands. Again at Black Bank, near Potterick Carr, before you get into the wetlands proper, there's Iron Age enclosures and settlement, and that pattern is seems to be repeated all over the borough. The more excavation that takes place in those areas, the more it seems that there's a connection throughout prehistory with the wetlands, but the settlement or the use is along the edges. It's not deep into the wetlands, except perhaps in the case of the Hatfield Trackway, which of course isn't evidence for settlement, but it is evidence for people using that landscape and or crossing that landscape. But again, it's attached to an island within a wetland landscape. Mm-hmm. So there's a possibility that the island itself had some limited settlement on it.
This is Lintong?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Before we actually come to talk about the trackway itself, are there any finds within the moor itself, within the wetlands of Thorn and Hatfield Moor?
There's a mixture of written record and actual objects which we can, you know, locate now. There's a lot of Bronze Age material, just stone axes. There's also before that there's a lot of Mesolithic, Neolithic flint scatters and a collection of flint tools. Then Iron Age, well, the Iron Age is difficult. There's less evidence, but certainly places like Sutton Common are turning up Iron Age artifacts. And then you have the reference to the odd find sort of way back in history. There are two references to bog bodies having been found on Thorn and Hatfield Moors. I think one was found in the 1700s, the other in the 1800s, from recollection. But there's very little information on those, other than that I think part of an arm or part of a leg was found, and a body was found in the moor and reburied. And it's very difficult to really judge what period they belong to or what they mean, because the evidence is scant from the point at which they were found. They could be, you know, it could be your sort of Lindo man, it could be an Iron Age bog body, or it could be something much later. It could be somebody who was crossing the moor in the 1600s, 1700s, and you know, fell foul of a pool of water, or it's really difficult to tell without having that physical evidence there to examine in a modern context, we'll just never know. But they're sort of like tasty tidbits, really, that get your imagination running and make you sort of think the possibilities are there. But also, I find them very annoying because, you know, for me, it's information lost. It's sort of that really exciting find that you want, that you sort of desire, and it's being found and lost, and all the information that you could have got from it in a modern context of archaeological research has gone as well, and all we can do is sort of say, well, you know, the opportunity's lost. You hope that it might, that something like that might present itself again sometime in the future.
Well, talking about exciting finds, I want to come on to talk about a recent find, the track, what we call in the trackway.
Yeah.
Perhaps if we could look at it from exactly how you came to this. What was the first you heard about this?
Right, okay. Well, the first I heard of it was Mick Oliver, the person who actually discovered the trackway. Or what we've called the trackway, phoned me. Now he'd had a relationship with Colin Howes. Previously, he'd done a lot of work with Colin Howes, looking at sort of the environment and sort of the natural aspect of the moors, and so he knew of the museum and he knew the staff here, but I'd never really met Mick before, maybe bumped into him once, twice. And he gave me a phone call and he said that he'd made this discovery of a trackway on Hatfield Moors, and asked if I would be prepared to come out and have a look at it, and try and confirm whether what he thought it was something of archaeological importance, and I sort of think in some ways I'm quite cynical, and I'm a bit of a pessimist, because when you get people phoning you up sometimes or writing to you, sometimes you can be disappointed. So I like to sort of I don't like to get too excited about things initially, because then it's really sort of upsetting when you find out that it's not something. So I think initially my first thought was, oh, you know, it's unlikely. I really couldn't bring myself to think that it was possible, because not because I didn't believe that somebody could recognise something like that. It was more because the moors had been so badly stripped in terms of peat milling that I just didn't think that in the area that he said he'd found it there was any chance that anything could have survived. But also the optimistic side of me said, you know, you've got to go check this out, because, you know, it's important, and that's my job. My job is to check these things out, but also to that's what we're there as a museum. We're there as a point of contact for the public, and there have been chance finds by members of the public before, not just here but all over the world. Some which have turned out to be the most fantastic things ever to be found. I sort of went out. We agreed a date and a time to go out there and have a look. And I sort of went out there mainly pessimistic and sort of thinking, oh, you know, it wouldn't be anything. It would end up being that I would have to disappoint him, and I hate that. I hate having to tell somebody that actually what they thought something was is nothing at all, because I don't like to disappoint people. So we sort of took a walk out to the site, and I found Mick a really sort of enthusiastic, quite intense person. He a bit like Colin actually, Colin Howes. He's somebody who enthuses about things and really kind of gets you excited about things, and I like that in people. I like that enthusiasm. So we got on we got on really well. We sort of hit it off on a good foot, and we were walking out to site, and I was looking at the landscape, just looking at how badly sort of stripped the landscape was in terms of the milling, and all the time I was just thinking, it's just going to be a collection of material in the peat, which is just natural, you know, sort of trees that have sort of blown over, or just sort of wood that's laying around in the peat from the process of trees sort of falling down, branches falling off and rotting and what have you. And we got out there, and by the side of they've created these ponds, almost artificial ponds, by creating lots of banks. They'd created these sort of square grid of ponds almost, by heaping up some of the peat into banks, making a grid, and got to one of these grids, and I saw this huge sort of pool of water, and on the edge of this pool of water, these sort of branches all laid out in a line. I sort of looked and I thought, well, yeah, that is curious. It doesn't look terribly natural, but again, I was still with my pessimistic head on. I thought, you know, I really don't want to say to him, yes, this is definitely a trackway, because I wanted to be a little more sure myself before I sort of got him excited or dashed his hopes. I brought a trowel along, we sort of looked at it, we discussed it, and I let Mick explain to me how he'd found it and whether he'd uncovered anything or whether he'd moved any soil, because I needed to get an idea of the context in which this thing was now sitting in the ground. And once I was happy that Mick had just sort of brushed off the dry peat that had been covering the surface of it, and that it was as it should be in the ground, untouched. I had a bit of a scrape around by some of the pieces of wood that were lying horizontally in a row, and I could see immediately that there was one long piece of wood beneath those, running in an opposite direction, almost like a train track, and that you'd got this one long length of wood with wood laying over the top of it, and the material around it seemed to be quite different from the general makeup of the peat. So at that point I was becoming a little less pessimistic and a little more optimistic, but I have to say I still wasn't entirely confident that it was something. This is about, I don't know, we'd maybe been out there 20 minutes, and I was reluctant to really do much more in terms of excavation around this feature, simply because if it was going to be something, then whatever I was doing was being done in an unrecorded manner, and so I was conscious of that. Although if I was then going to be going off and contacting other archaeologists and getting them to come out and look at it, I had to be a little more sure about what it was, because I didn't want to be wasting people's time. So I had a little more of a clean up of it, and I think once I'd kind of cleaned the whole area up, and I'd had a little I'd excavated a little 50 centimetre by 50 centimetre slot around the back end of this feature, I'd decided that it was certainly most likely that it was something archaeological. Although my experience of trackways or of these sort of wetland features is very limited. It's really from my sort of studies and what I've read. But I've never had any. I've never excavated anything of that nature before. So I was a little unsure about it. But I was certainly sure at the end of about an hour with Mick that we'd got something that was very promising, and I was getting more convinced that we'd definitely got something archaeological, and if that was the case, where it was, it had to be A, old, B, very unusual, and C, probably quite rare, because there's only one other known find from the area, and that's the trackway at Thorn, which of course is very, very different to this find. So at that point, I sort of said to Mick, well, you know, I really think we've got something here, and I actually thought, and I still think to this day, I'm amazed at how he found it, because I think most archaeologists would struggle to have recognised it as something just by crossing across a vast area of more like that, particularly when you've got so much organic material in terms of wood and tree and tree stumps and what have you lying around. I'm still amazed that he noticed it. I think, you know, it's an incredibly keen eye, an intelligent eye for somebody who has no archaeological background to notice something like that, and then to have the conviction to believe that it is a trackway, so I sort of gave him the good news in that I thought it was something, and then we discussed what to do from then, really, and that was really that we needed to contact the Sites and Monuments Record, the Archaeological Service, also contact English Heritage, I also had a contact with the wetlands unit at Hull University, Henry Chapman, who'd been working on other projects in the Humberhead Levels. And so I thought immediately to contact those three organisations and see if I could get one or all of them to come out and have a look at this, because obviously then time was of the essence. This thing was exposed, and you know, there was a large pool of water at the side of it which could well have expanded and covered it over. Or equally could have retracted and the whole thing could have dried up, and we were certainly conscious that the longer it took to get somebody out to it, the less of it would remain, because once it had been uncovered, it was just going to disappear bit by bit as it either dried up or got wetter and wetter. So we did just that. We went back to the office. I immediately contacted the SMR, English Heritage, and Henry Chapman at the Wetland Unit at Hull, and I think it was we managed to get everybody to agree to a site meeting, at which me and Mick were then invited back, I wasn't able to attend that site meeting because of something else I had on at the museum, but as I understand it, They all met up on site, and several of the group were not convinced that it was archaeological. Although Henry was sort of adamant that it was something that ought to be investigated. And since the Humber Wetlands project covered that area, it was easy to fit it into an already existing study, and from that point plans were made to sort of go back and have a look at it, do some controlled excavation and study of the site, leading to what we've ended up with thus far today, which is well, not a trackway, it seems, or rather it is there is part of a walkway that leads to a possible platform. Now my involvement in the project since Mick's initial discovery has been relatively slight, in that I've taken the usual role of a museum curator, and that is to keep an eye on the project and to monitor it. I went out, had a few days actually excavating with the wetland team, but other than that, I've sort of kept a distance really from the project and let the archaeologists get on with it, and then just sort of sat back and waited for the reports to come in. And it seems that they believe it to be a walkway that leads out to a platform. So it's not a trackway in the sense that it only goes so far and then terminates. And I know Mick isn't happy with that, he sort of doesn't agree with the archaeologists, and they don't agree with his view of things, and I sort of prefer to take a back seat on that. I've had sort of discussions with Mick, and I've had discussions with the archaeologists, and you know, as with everybody, I have my own opinions as well, and I'm not entirely sure I agree with either in some cases, but I think that Mick has some very valid points in terms of looking at the what's left of any archaeological feature, and the one thing that Mick points out is that a great deal of what was there has been stripped away, and so what the archaeologists are looking at is really what's the remnants of what's left of a once complete feature. And it's on this that the archaeologists are basing their theories of what it is. But I do think that Mick has a point in terms of being cautious about trying to decide what it is when what you're looking at is not complete. So my opinion is that I'm not entirely sure of whether that platform does terminate, or whether it could have gone on perhaps to another platform even, or have led somewhere else entirely. But certainly what seems to be there is, and this is irrefutable, is that there is a length of track which leads to something which expands out into a more sort of platformed area. Past that, it's very difficult to say, because then it's theory and assumption, because there's nothing else there. So the archaeologist's argument is that, you know, the platform, it terminates at a platform, and therefore it's something which has some religious significance. Mick thinks that platform may have been a stopping point at which there was a further length of track that may have led elsewhere, and there's a good chance that he may be right with that. But since I haven't been wholly involved with the excavation, it's very difficult to say. And taking a more balanced view on it, I would say that both have a good chance of being right. And that's the thing with archaeology sometimes, is it's open to interpretation, it's open to opinion, and it's open to theory. So there are no hard and fast "this is what it is" rules. It's simply a matter of how you interpret the evidence, and I think that there are many possibilities.
And the trackway, have you got any idea where it leads from? Has it got a landfall?
It does. The landfall, it almost island hops, actually. What you have is Lindome Island, which is a large part of a glacial moraine, which is a sort of sand and gravel landscape that's being cut through by water. And where it's being cut through by water, you have a build-up of peat from sort of low-lying wetland areas. Lindholm's this large sort of island of sand and gravel, and the track seems to lead towards that and hits a smaller island, almost like a peninsula of the larger island. It seems to sort of lead from Lindholm Island out into the lower lying wetland area, and then just stops. Whether it stops because the rest has been destroyed, or whether it stops because that was the point at which it was built to is difficult to say, but it certainly would lead you either way to conclude that the focus of attention is the island itself, and that is that whoever's built this has built it from the island heading out into the wetland. Whether there are any other routes that come into that island, because of course it's surrounded by wetland, is open to speculation. You would hope that perhaps something else might be discovered, or something else might survive elsewhere that might prove that the island is just a stopping point. But certainly if you look back in history, islands that sit in wetlands seem to be a focus of people's attentions, and almost always seem to have some religious connection as well, some non-domestic, non-functional purpose. One that I'm thinking of course is Glastonbury Tor, which is a very famous island that sits in a wetland environment, and
Lindholm itself of course has its own reputation for hermits and
monastic
people,
and there seems to be some evidence, not proven by archaeological fact, but some evidence that in Lindholm Hall there is remnants of an older building or older structure on that site, I think the likelihood is that the island has been used as a secluded place, but also it's the perfect place to be used for more sort of religious activity, because what people seek is in terms of religious observances is often seclusion and also that kind of otherworldly feel that the island has, sitting in a huge sort of marshland, very uninviting, very unfriendly, just sort of quite ethereal feel about it.
What date has been put onto the trackway?
I believe that they've done some. They've had some dendrochronological dating, which has come back as Neolithic, so the trackway's a lot earlier than the Bronze Age trackway at on Thornmoor.
And how important and how significant is it as a find?
Well, as a Neolithic feature, it probably makes it one of the most important discoveries nationally in decades. You have very famous features like the Sweet Track, which of course is a trackway,
in the Somerset Land.
Yeah, and is Neolithic, and it's one of a it's one of a kind for this country. Most of these sort of trackways and platforms tend to be regularly found in Ireland, but they're not so regularly found over here. And this is in terms of a feature for this country, it's unique. And with it being dated as Neolithic, it's one of the earliest structures of its kind as well in this country. So it's of national importance.
Did you say it predates the Sweet Track?
I'm not actually sure whether.
Or are they likely to be?
I'm not. I'm actually not sure whether it predates. I mean, it's the same period, mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't know whether it predates or postdates the Sweet Track.
Just give us a little bit of context, say comparing it when date terms with, say, Stonehenge, which you obviously know something about.
Mm-hmm. It's difficult because I'm not entirely sure whether it's been dated early or late, early, middle or late Neolithic. But in terms of fitting it into a sort of national archaeological picture, I suspect that it ties in with the very early wooden phases of Stonehenge, which are late Neolithic. It ties in with features like your long barrows and your sort of banked and ditched henge monuments at Thornborough. And you're really looking at a point in time when people are just starting to settle in the landscape, are starting to move from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to a more sedentary farming lifestyle. But it would be wrong to think that they're completely settled at this point in time. Certainly in this area, because what you have is it's not quite the same picture as in the south of England, where the advent of farming in the Neolithic means that people are becoming almost completely sedentary. The concept in our area would be that there's some farming being undertaken in the upland areas. But they're also still moving around with their livestock, particularly because it's better land up here for the raising of livestock, and any raising of herd animals means that you have to move them around, and particularly it's a good area for that because you can move them from the uplands to the wetlands. In a sort of rotational pattern, but also the people are exploiting the wetlands at the same time as using the dry uplands. So that there's some indication that whilst they have sedentary bases, they're still in some respect moving around the landscape as they had done previously in the Mesolithic. And continuing some, perhaps a more limited hunter-gatherer lifestyle, which is being far more supported by farming and the raising of livestock. So it's the two are sort of happening in sync. That's the sort of picture into which this feature fits. In terms of what's happening in the landscape, it's a sort of we've got an event horizon, and that is that the area around Lindholm Island, particularly the Humberhead Levels in general, have been relatively dry, and are suddenly getting wetter and wetter, and it's at this point that our short trackway and platform exist. They're being put down at a point when that area is becoming wetter and wetter. So you can imagine perhaps a couple of hundred years or less before the existence of the Hatfield trackway, people are crossing that landscape. It's a fairly dry landscape, and then it becomes wetter and wetter, and less possible to cross, until at some point it's impossible to cross that landscape, particularly with herds or and probably even alone. It would be quite a dangerous undertaking, and so there's suddenly a change in the connection that people have with that landscape, whether it's because they're trying to figure out what's happening, or whether it's because they have a different understanding or different belief about what wetland areas mean or what significance they have to them. It's difficult to say, but they're certainly interacting with it.
So we're talking about the time before the peat was there.
Yes. Essentially, the track. Well, it's at the point at which the first layers of peat would be starting to form. So the material beneath the track is there are some levels of peat, I believe, beneath the track, but it's also very sort of silty material. So it's the very sort of start of the wetting of that area, and the track sort of laid onto that. So it's at a point when something's changing, perhaps within the lifetime of the people that are building this feature. And that it's their reaction to this change, and that reaction, I suspect it has some religious connection, because as with most things, people like to see something as having, when people can't understand a reason for something happening, it's often ascribed to something otherworldly, whether you want to call that God or gods or whatever.
We have been talking for a long time, so you probably need to finish fairly soon, but you've mentioned the other track at Thorn.
Yes.
Could you tell me something about that?
I can tell you a little bit about that. I think it was found in the late 70s, early 80s, and it was partially excavated by staff at the museum. And that's a very different feature. That is sort of cut shaped planks of wood laid down in the formation of a track and staked. Where that's going to and where it's leading from is again difficult to say, because of the nature of how it was found and the limited excavation that took place. It was really just an exploratory excavation of the part that was found, that had turned up from peat milling. But that's much later. That I believe is Bronze Age. And that really is a bit more along the lines of the idea of the sweet track, and that is something which is laid down to allow people to cross, to cross a wet landscape, whether that's moving themselves or moving herds, and it's difficult to say, but that would be the assumption that people are trying to get from one point to the other. And the thing that's in their way, they get around by building a platform which can support
to support their weight as they cross a wet area.
And these, are there any other similar kinds of tracks in the area, or there's just these two?
There's only those two that are recorded. I mean, there are plenty of rumours of other things being found on Thorn and Hatfield Moors, parts of trackways, and objects as well, even bog bodies, even further bog bodies, but none of them are, you know, we can't put any of those rumours to bed because we don't have the evidence to prove it. They are just sort of either local rumours or local, I suppose you'd call them rural myths rather than urban myths. But it's frustrating because they can't, you know, they can't be proved. And as an archaeologist or a scientist, you want to be able to prove something before you fully believe it.
Just to finish, do you know if there's any future work planned on the Lindholm track?
As I understand it, it will be an ongoing study now, which will encompass the landscape around that find as well. Certainly, there are, I think, future planned seasons of excavation of the trackway itself, although I think it's coming close to being written up now. After that, I'm not entirely sure what's going to happen with it. What I do know as of this time is that it's thought that the feature won't be able to be preserved in situ. So if anything, it will be completely excavated. And that's kind of sad because it is of national importance, and it would be nice to think that it was possible to preserve it for future generations, but also for future scientific study as science improves, techniques improve, and it would be nice to think that we could preserve it so that archaeologists could come back and look at it again in the future. But it really just doesn't seem possible to do that because it's so badly damaged anyway in terms of the level of its exposure, that it wouldn't survive if it were now to be covered over. It would continue to decay and eventually disappear from the archaeological record. So I believe that the course of action that's been chosen is to completely excavate it in order to be able to completely understand what's left of it, and then perhaps to recreate it for people to see how it might have looked when it was complete, when it was freshly built.
Thank you very much indeed.
Okay, you're welcome.